questions to go to wrap this up, and we're kind of on to a new section, as it were. So grab your Bibles. We'll quick read 2 Timothy chapter 2 to get started, because as we kind of turn this corner, I want to reiterate again, you know, kind of some of the purpose of why we're doing this class, and what our goal is in relation to our call to ministry, and, you know, what Scripture would have us do as members of the body of Christ. So 2 Timothy chapter 2, starting in verse 23, says, "But foolish and unlearned questions avoid, knowing they do gender strife." And that's part of what we're doing in this logic class. We're trying to cut through what are foolish questions, what are, you know, just stupid statements, what are things that we cannot prove, we cannot align with the laws of logic. So foolish and unlearned questions avoid, knowing they do gender strifes. And the servant of the Lord must not strive. Now again, if we want to consider ourselves to be servants of God and servants of the Lord, what is one of the things we're not supposed to be doing?
Striving.
We're not going to be striving about stupid questions, right? We're going to make the main thing the main thing. And instead, we're supposed to be gentle to all men, apt to teach. So if you want to consider yourself a servant of the Lord, do you need to have some skill and ability in being able to teach? Mm-hmm. And how do you be able to teach? You have to first learn. And you also have to learn how to properly think about certain issues so that you can talk about those issues from a more educated or learned standpoint. And be patient. In meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves. And we've talked a lot about this with statements that are in contradiction to one another. You're opposing yourself when you put out a position that ultimately undermines your position. Or if you put something out claiming you're a Christian, and the position you're holding actually undermines one of the tenets of the Christian faith, you're opposing yourself. Anything that's against the knowledge of God, for example, you might hold in contention. And the result, or what we're really aiming for, if God peradventure will give them repentance to the acknowledging of the truth, and that they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil, who are taken captive by him at his will. So that's what our goal is, right? We're trying to persuade men that Christ is our Messiah. He is the one who has redeemed us. God is real. The Bible is true. All the doctrines of the faith are coherent, and we want people to eventually acknowledge that. So that's why we're doing what we're doing. That's why we're spending so much time talking about this, because it is serious. We are losing, I think, that battle in the culture as we follow culture into being less and less logical, and also with that relevant. Because once you lose logic and everyone has their own truth, we lose all relevance. It's kind of like on that movie The Incredibles, when everyone's super, no one is. Well, when we're all stupid, then no one's brilliant. So we all are equally ignorant and stupid together. All right, so on the notes then, we have completed our study of categorical logic. So everybody can, you know, yay, praise the Lord. We're done with more of the mathematical side of things. So all of that difficult stuff is behind us, and we're kind of turning a corner into some of the more, fun stuff. This is what people typically think of when they think of logic, on the funner side, because this sells better typically. So we're done with categorical logic. We'll now be moving on to a few lessons regarding informal fallacies. So you can see that chart there, that flow chart on the bottom of the page. Recall from earlier on in this course that we looked at some of the branches of logic. Early on, we talked about, if you see under informal logic, we talked about terms, right? Defining our terms, you know, the importance of that. We talked about statements. What is a statement? And then we jumped over to formal logic. We went to deductive reasoning and looked at categorical logic. We spent quite a long time under categorical logic. So now we're going back to informal logic, and we're looking at the third and final branch of informal fallacies. So we have seen how to distinguish between a valid and an invalid syllogism. We've practiced constructing valid syllogisms, putting statements into categorical statements, putting those into shorthand, finding forms, all that kind of stuff. So we did all that you know, math stuff, basically, reducing and reducing and reducing until we get a very small form of an argument. So the informal fallacies, however, are more of the quote-unquote street fighting logic. This is more likely what you're going to use in everyday conversation. Now, the other stuff is important, but that's mostly going to be like when you have time to sit down and analyze, like, what did they claim, what did they write, what did they say in their video, and you have time to sit down and analyze it. This is more of the, like, off-the-cuff talking with people that you're going to use and people are going to use. These are things that we use every day. If you ever watch politics, you're going to see a lot of this happening. So these are the street fighting logic, meaning both that it is not as neat and orderly as formal logic, and that you are more likely to see it out in the street. So this is a little less technical. It is less mathematical and just structured. So it is not as clean. It's a little more dirty than deductive categorical logic. So last week we learned that we learned some formal fallacies, or of denying the antecedent, I should say of rather than or, of denying the antecedent and affirming the consequence. You guys remember that from hypothetical syllogisms last week, where you had those two formal fallacies. But today we want to focus on informal forms of reasoning that are invalid or unhelpful in an argument. So any questions on review before we jump into these? You guys remember last week going through those two formal fallacies. All right, so hopefully these ones are easier for you guys to pinpoint than the formal ones. The formal ones are very technical, right? You have to look at the syllogism, you have to look at the if-then statements, and then decide if you're making one of those mistakes. These are a little more straightforward in my mind, at least. These are easier for me to jump onto. So with all of these fallacies, there is an improper way or an invalid way to use them. There's also a proper way, or a way to kind of change it a little bit so it is proper. So fallacies of distraction. So this whole section today are just going to be fallacies, informal fallacies, that fall into the category that I am distracting you from the argument somehow, or I am distracting from the point of contention by introducing information that's not really relevant. So there's going to be 9 different kinds of that, and there are more, so I would advise you to, like, look some of this stuff up. There are more examples. I'm just going to give you 9 common ones that we see day to day. But these are introduction of information that is not useful to the argument at hand and distracts from what we're actually talking about. So we want to consider fallacy distraction, arguments that point us to information that seems relevant to the conclusion but is not really relevant. So then we had a little redundancy there. So how can we tell the difference between things that seem pertinent and things that are not? Well, we have to use wisdom. You have to really think about it and try to determine that. So here are definitions. We got a little typo there. That should say definitions. Number one, informal fallacy definition is a popular but invalid or unhelpful form of argument. So sometimes they're completely invalid, or sometimes they might be valid, but they're completely unhelpful to the actual conversation. They really don't have anything to do with what we're talking about. They might sound good, they might sound like something that might go, maybe they're related, but they really don't actually get to the point of contention. So, a fallacy of distraction is an argument that confuses the issue by pointing to information that is actually irrelevant to the conclusion. These are also known as red herrings. So this whole section of distraction are called red herrings. Has anyone ever heard of a red herring?
Yeah.
So these are all various kinds of red herrings where I'm distracting you from what we're actually talking about and what we're supposed to be debating. So here are a few types. So number one, ipsi dixit. This is Latin for he said it himself. This fallacy is committed when illegitimate appeal is made to an authority. So it could be illegitimate either because appealing to any authority on the matter isn't helpful. For example, my feelings about ice cream. So if I tell you my favorite ice cream is Hudsonville Deer Tracks and a waffle cone, appealing to any authority does not make sense. right? So if you say, well, you know, Dr. So-and-so said that that's not really a good ice cream, so you shouldn't like it. It doesn't matter. That's my favorite ice cream. So appealing, it doesn't matter. You could appeal to any and every authority out there. It makes no difference to me liking Hudsonville, you know, deer tracks and a waffle cone. That is my favorite. I will eat it. I don't care. So because the quote-unquote expert isn't an authority on the matter being discussed. So it doesn't matter, you know, Dr. Ice Cream Man says that actually the best flavor is whatever. It doesn't matter because it's about what I want, what I prefer. So there is no authority you can appeal to change my mind. That is what I like. So the other way is because the expert himself isn't an expert in whatever matter you're talking about. So they might be an expert, and I have here, like, Richard Dawkins, a renowned biologist, says there is no God. Tucker Carlson, a respected journalist, says that dispensationalism was invented by Darby and therefore not trustworthy. Now, Richard Dawkins is a PhD biologist, but what does that have to do with whether or not God exists? So just because he says he doesn't believe in God as a biologist, does that really mean anything? No. Same with Tucker Carlson. He's a journalist. Is he a world-renowned theologian? No. He's not an expert in that field. That's not his field of study. So just because he says something, we don't care. Now, when it's not necessarily a fallacy, is that next point there, not all appeals to authority are necessarily invalid. For example, we often quote the Bible to dispel contentions of Christian doctrine. So again, if we're talking about Christian doctrine, appealing to the Bible as an authority is a valid way to appeal to an authority, because that is the point. Like, the Bible is where we get our doctrine. So if we want to talk about doctrine, we're going to have to necessarily appeal to the Bible. You know, so the same would be true about anything. If you're going to look at, you know, medical issues, it's not wrong to cite medical doctors about medical issues, because that is their, you know, field of study. But if I'm going to talk about medical stuff, I'm probably not going to quote some guy who's got a PhD in psychology. Okay, it's not, if I want to know what, like, causes cancer, I'm not going to go to the psychologist. I'm going to go to, you know, some guy who actually, what is a cancer doctor?
Oncologist.
Is that?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was something different. An oncologist, right? Because they're the ones studying this. So I'm going to go to somebody that studies cancer to ask questions about cancer, not to a psychologist.
But don't you think this happens a lot?
Oh, of course.
Where, like, I remember my professors in college, they got degrees in, say, Old Testament literature and something else, but yet they feel qualified to speak authoritatively about quantum physics.
Right.
That's a random example, but it happens all the time.
Right. I mean, we do this quite often. I mean, how many of you have multiple PhDs in different fields? No. But do we have an opinion on pretty much every field? And it's not wrong to have an opinion, but then if you're going to stake authority, who do you usually have to go to? You got to find an expert in that field that agrees with your opinion and then say, this is the guy. So, yeah, there is, we're all susceptible to this. We all do this on occasion, and people do it to us all the time. I mean, you know, just watch social media. When anything happens, all of a sudden everybody becomes a political expert, and then all of a sudden something religious, and then they're a religious expert, and then all of a sudden something happens sociological, and they're all sociologists. Something else happens, they're all good historians, and, you know, people just change to whatever, and they know, they definitely know all those things. So, yeah, appeals to authority are not always invalid. So that's where we have to make that distinction. What is a legitimate appeal to an authority? Is that authority actually pertinent to what we're talking about? So in the case of doctrine, going to the Bible is an appropriate authority. So can you guys think of another way that appeal to an authority would be okay?
As long as the authority is relevant to
right.
the discussion.
The authority has to be relevant to the discussion. So in your day-to-day life, what is something you would need to appeal to authority with?
Auto mechanic.
I've gone through the YouTube University on my car. I can't figure it out. I'm going to have to take it to a mechanic. let him run some diagnostic tests. Yeah. What about at work?
Your boss?
Yeah, I might have to, you know, appeal to my boss if a coworker is going outside of, you know, whatever the employee handbook says. They're acting outside of the employee handbook. I could reference the employee handbook, or I could appeal to the boss and say, hey, boss doesn't want us doing that, right? And that's a legitimate appeal to authority because that is the subject matter. All right, so we understand appeal to authority. We want it to be accurate to what we're talking about, legitimate authority. You know, obviously, I'm not going to just appeal to some random guy. This happens a lot in churches as well, right? Especially, you know, pastor-led churches where, why are we doing this? Well, the pastor said to. Okay, but this doesn't seem right. Yeah, but the pastor is the boss. Well, yeah, but this seems like it goes against some of the stuff the Bible says. Yeah, but that's, we have to. I mean, I've been there. I've had to do things because the pastor told me to that I knew directly went against the Bible, but what are you going to do? It's a pastor. It's God's man. So you have to do it, right? So this definitely affects churches. It affects religion, and it happens quite often. The second one is ad populum, and it means to the masses. So have you ever appealed to, like, popular opinion? Everybody says, da-da-da-da-da. So this fallacy is an appeal to the mass of the masses. So the majority of the masses, what they think, everyone knows that Trump supporters are all Nazis. Right? Everybody knows that, so it must be true. We all know it. this fallacy conflates truth with what people generally like or agree with. So I am making a statement based on what people generally say or generally agree to. But it kind of goes back to, like, if all your friends jumped off a bridge, would you? Just because everybody jumps off the bridge doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. So this, I got an example here. This story must be truly great. It's a bestseller. So what's the problem?
The certainty of the statement.
The certainty of the statement. It has to be a truly great story. Why? Because, well, yeah, it sold a lot of copies. Could there be reasons why it sold a lot of copies other than
it
could?
Buying it to burn it.
They're buying it to burn it. Somebody, right, there could be, you know, a cultural reason why everybody hates it so much they buy it to burn it. There could be a really wealthy person that has a vested interest in seeing this book succeed, so they buy up a bunch of copies.
Good advertising.
They got a lot of hubbub. Maybe the author is already a really good author, and they just put out some garbage because, you know, their printing house or whatever said, hey, we need another book, like, right now, even though they don't have a good idea for a book, because, hey, your last one sold really, really well. It was a great story, so we need another one right now. And they just put out garbage just because it's hot and selling. So they just ride that wave of fame. That never happens, though. All right, so an example of not ad populum. So many have found the Bible to be a profitable book. You should read it, too. Why is this not necessarily illegitimate?
It's not totalizing.
Right. I'm just saying, hey, there's been a lot of people that found benefit in this thing. Maybe it's something you should try as well. Maybe you'll find benefit. It's a lot more soft just saying, hey, this is something we've observed. Maybe give it a try. And I'm not saying, hey, this has to be the greatest thing that's ever happened in the world because everyone has always benefited. Because the honest truth is, if you're going to live godly, what's going to happen to you? They'll suffer persecution. So if you're going to actually read and follow the Bible, it's not always going to turn out great in this life for you. So if I told somebody now, I mean, are there churches out there who do teach if you follow God, you'll always come up on the up and up and God will give you everything you need, want, desire. You're going to be happy, wealthy. Yeah, famous, you're going to succeed in business, everything. It's going to all go as long as you give, you know, $99.99 every week to this address. You'll always come up smelling like roses. All right, so both fallacy one and two could also be used as manipulation. So fallacy number one, remember, was ipsy dixit, and then ad populum. Both of these can be used in manipulation and often are. This is called triangulation. So both of these would fall under triangulation if somebody was trying to manipulate you. So the manipulator in triangulation, the manipulator uses a third party or several quote-unquote witnesses, often not present, to discredit you. So Couple examples. So they will say something like, all the experts say that you're wrong about this. Why is that manipulative?
Who are these experts?
Exactly. All the experts, and who are they? And yeah, you've read them all and looked at everything they had to say to know for sure that I'm wrong about this issue. Or, on a little more personal, everyone who knows you well says you're crazy. Well, it might be accurate, but yes, this is this. Both of those are examples of those two first fallacies that would be used more in a personal manipulation tactic, right? So this is called triangulation. So you can see what some of those problems. So these are things that also we want to avoid in our marriages and relationships, right? You always do that. Everyone knows you always do that. These are not things we want to say. Anybody ever do that?
Always.
I've done it. Always.
Every time without
Yes, there is no exception. It's going to happen every single time. All right, number three, ad baculum, means to the stick. So this is an appeal to force or violence. So again, we're having a conversation. It's not going my way. I decide I need to convince you by a maybe, you know, a little more violent threat. So an ad baculum is often a thinly veiled threat. It's kind of like a backhanded compliment. Sometimes you're like, is that a threat or was that a compliment? Or parents are pros at ad baculum. Especially when you have kids that like to do their own thing. Parents can become really good at these. So, let's give some examples from political. If you vote for the orange man, he will commit violence against our community and we will be forced to preemptively defend ourselves from you people. So what is the thinly veiled threat in that? Yeah, I'm going to hurt you if you don't vote the way I say you should vote. So is that a good argument if we're trying to decide what's a good candidate? No, it distracts from the point. Like if we're talking politics and want to say, hey, are these good policies? Are these, you know, better policies? What, you know, what are they promising? If I say, well, if you don't do what I say, I'm going to hurt you or your community, well, then that really doesn't help us decide which candidate has a better policy. Right, yeah, self-fulfilled prophecy. I'm going to prophesy it and then do it. And then it came true. So a legitimate use of ad baculum. If you do not see the wisdom of our laws against murder, so I might be saying this to somebody who is contemplating murder as a judge. If you do not see the legitimate or the wisdom of our laws against murder, perhaps you will be persuaded by our death penalty. And that is a legitimate use because I am putting it out there as this is, I'm assuming this is a judge talking to a convict that does not want to follow the laws about murder and saying, look, if you're not going to follow that, that's fine. Maybe here's a different persuasion. We also have a death sentence in this country. Maybe think twice before committing murders. All right, so number four then is appeal to fear. Now, this is similar to ad baculum. They're kind of under the same thing because I am drawing from somebody's fear of something, right? In ad baculum, it's fear of violence against them or force against them. With appeal to fear, I would say it's slightly different. It could be an offshoot, but it's an appeal to fear is framing of the argument to cause people to reconsider the position due to emotional distress. So not necessarily of being physically attacked, but this is going to result in something that's going to cause you great emotional distress. So the reason I didn't include an ad baculum is that I see ad baculum more along the line of a personal threat, while appealing to fear can use a slippery slope to a fearful future. So an example, if you don't vote for Senator Snout Snuffle, the ozone layer will be destroyed and we will all die soon die. So am I threatening you with physical violence?
No.
No, I'm not threatening you, but what sort of picture am I painting for your future?
It's not bright.
It's not bright. So what's the problem with this? Because we definitely see this sort of rhetoric in politics today about ozone layers and everything else. If we hire this guy versus this guy, how likely is it to completely reverse all the so-called climate change in one guy? There's a 0% chance that if this is, you know, really doomsday marching down, that one guy getting in is going to reverse everything. Like, that's not even a point of contention. That's not going to happen. So, could I appeal to people's fear that this might happen to get them to vote a certain way?
Yeah, we do it all the time.
We do it all the time, right? This is a common rhetoric in politics today. If you don't vote for this particular individual, the whole system's going to fall apart. There's going to be, you know, death in the streets, chaos everywhere. The ozone's going to burn up. We're all going to die. Like, we have to vote for this person. Existential crisis or collapse of democracy. It's going to happen. Right. Yeah. They're eating their cats and dogs. So, a legitimate use. The Bible teaches and evidence shows that abstinence can lead to a more successful life, while fornication can lead to unplanned pregnancies, psychological issues, disease, and other complications. Which one should you choose? So why is this not illegitimate?
True.
Well, it is true. But also, I'm leaving it up to them, right?
Yeah, you're not.
I'm not trying to force their decision. I'm just laying out, here are some facts. Here's what evidence shows. Which one should you choose? And I'm leaving it on you. I'm not telling you, you have to choose this one or else. Saying, look, this is, if you choose this one, this is the more likely outcome. If you choose this one, this is the most likely outcome. You know, I'm just arming them with some stats and facts and whatever else.
But if you said in the second one, God will smite you with boils.
Correct. Yeah, so if I change that to, yes, if you don't do this, God will strike you dead or smite you with boils. Actually, talking to you about this morning, God might kill my husband because he's not living right. Happens all the time. I had another example, actually that same church. The youth pastor and wife needed to leave, and the wife said, no, I'm afraid if we leave this church, we'll be out of God's will, and God might kill one of our kids in order to get us back in line with his will. Is that sort of rhetoric used from pulpits all the time? If you don't do what God wants you to do, God will make sure to drop you dead or take your kid or get you sick or you'll be in a car accident or finances will all of a sudden dry up. God will get you back where he wants you. So, yeah, this happens all the time in church, too. It's not just a world problem, it's a church problem. All right, number 5, ad hominem, or to the man. This fallacy is a verbal attack against your opponent or their character rather than the argument they presented. Now, thank the Lord this one never happens in Christian circles. You know, this never happens Christian to Christian, ever. So, a couple examples. Yes, we know that you maintain the sun rises in the east every morning, but we also know you're a jerk. So does the sun rising in the east have, is that any effect that you're a jerk that said it?
No.
Could it be true you're a jerk? It could be true, but does it impact at all where the sun rises? Absolutely not. So, you know, obviously we have this quite often.
You're not a Bible believer.
You're not a Bible believer because, so we don't need to listen to what you say. I don't need to consider whatever argument, evidence, or whatever you're putting on the table because you're not a Bible believer. We all know that. So we could be ad populum as well. Everyone knows you're not really. So this goes with everything. We're not going to listen to what you have to say because you're a dispensationalist. Right? You're just one of those hyper dispensationalist people, so we don't have to listen to what you say. Or you're a Calvinist, so obviously you're a staunch hyper-Calvinist, you have nothing good to say either. Right? So we all do this to each other. It's one of those tactics to be able to just dismiss your opponent. You're saying, okay, I don't want to do all the hard work to consider what you're saying, so I'll just label you something and then pass you along. Now, did that make your argument go away?
No.
But if I have a crowd that also couldn't care less and I dismiss it, did I just dismiss it for the whole room?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's one of the problems we run into in a lot of churches. You know, if the pastor gets up there and says, ah, we don't have to worry about that, they're just a heathen. Problem is, if you keep doing that, especially in a position of leadership, you dismiss every other idea that comes into the church as it's just this, they're just that, and you keep dismiss. What kind of impact do you think that has on the next generation coming up?
Negative.
It is negative, but why?
It's in the thing.
They're never learning to engage with material. And they're never learning, like, okay, why do we believe it, and why is the other position inadequate? So, again, does this lead to some issues? I've had quite a few friends grow up in the church, bright kids, good kids, some of them even homeschooled everything in the church, great kid, get to college and realize none of their questions were ever answered, and, well, maybe there are no answers. Maybe this is all fake. Nobody will talk to me. And they got cut off from every other denomination, every other church. Don't talk to them. They're heathens. They're heretics. They're whatever. Don't talk to anybody but your pastor. And pastor doesn't have any answers or doesn't want to answer questions. Well, then maybe this ain't true. I'm an atheist now.
Yeah.
It's happened way too many times to people I know to say it doesn't happen. All right. So, what is a non-illegitimate use of ad hominem? The second point under there, how can we believe your testimony? You've been convicted of perjury 3 times in the past 2 years. So is that more of a legitimate use?
Yeah.
Because it has to deal with the actual issue, right? We're questioning whether or not you're an honest person. Why are we questioning if you're an honest person? Because you've been dishonest under oath 3 times in the last 2 years, right? So,
which is objective.
Right, that's an objective thing. We have it on record that you've been convicted of this 3 times in the last 2 years, so I'm having some struggle believing your testimony right now. So that's not an illegitimate, that would be more of a legitimate use of ad hominem. Because, yeah, would we want this individual to show us some reason why we should believe their testimony?
Yeah.
I think an irrational person, if they knew this, would probably question whether or not they were telling the truth this time, especially if there was something on the line for them. All right, so number 6, bulverism. So this is dismissing an argument by simply pointing out that the one presenting the argument, or how or why the one presenting the argument came to believe it. So this is also known as a genetic fallacy. So in other words, you attack a position by pointing out how the arguer came to hold that position rather than the argument's merits or demerits.
Distraction.
Right, I'm distracting from the point. So this is a fallacy unless the person's reason for adopting the argument is truly relevant to your original argument. So this fallacy is often follows the form. You only believe that because you are a blank, fill in the blank, so I don't need to believe that. So this is similar to the ad hominem as well. I could use it as an ad hominem if I wanted to. I'm saying that you grew up, you know, basically what they have here. You're saying that infants shouldn't be baptized because you grew up in a Baptist home. I grew up in a Baptist home, and I say infants shouldn't be baptized, but is it just because I grew up in a Baptist home?
No.
Is that always the case? Now, could it be the case that somebody grew up in a Baptist home and that's their only real reason for saying that? Sure. But are you dismissing, you know, say I laid out an argument why you shouldn't baptize infants and they say that to it? You know, I lay out what I believe to be a thoughtful, biblical reason, go to scripture and say, hey, this is why you shouldn't baptize babies, and they say that. Is that really hitting the point of contention of the argument? Or is it distracting from what we're talking about?
It's distracting from the fact that you can't prove your argument based on your argument.
Exactly. So a non-bulverism here would be, you are running for Congress as a Democrat today, but yesterday you lost the Republican primary. You are just maintaining the Democrat platform because of personal ambition. So why is this one not bulverism?
There's seemingly an objective failed attempt to gain
good Republican over here, and in 24 hours they're completely changed their mind and opinion on everything, and now they're a Democrat. It's highly unlikely. I mean, it could happen. That's possible. But if we're going to go with probabilities, we know he lost the Republican primary 24 hours earlier. Now he's running as a Democrat. What's more likely the case? It's more likely the case that he wants to be in Congress for whatever reason, for money, for power, influence or whatever. He wants to be in Congress. He doesn't care which party he's there as long as he's there. Yes.
I would also add that this example would be abductive logic.
Sure.
Where you are reasoning out based on known facts.
Correct.
To a
right.
Reasonable conclusion.
Right.
That's just personal ambition.
Right.
This person is.
So again, with these, it's not necessarily black and white like with categorical logic where you have to follow this form or it's automatically invalid. With this, it's more spectral. You have to look at the facts. So does that, if we're looking at somebody running for an office and questioning, okay, you were running as a Republican yesterday, you lost the nomination. Today, 24 hours later, you're running again now as a Democrat. And I got to look at those facts and say, is this person legitimate? Logically speaking, probably not. There's a high probability he's only doing this for personal ambition. He wants to be in Congress. He doesn't care which category, or he's going over as a spy, or he tried to go into the Republicans as a spy to try to sway votes as a Republican or whatever else. So, your reasoning based on objective facts. We know he ran yesterday. The polls came in. He didn't do well. Okay, that's a fact. We all can look at that. Now today he's put his hat in the ring at the opposite party. We can all look at that. There's not a lot of options why you would do that in a legitimate fashion. If we were giving him the full benefit of the doubt, he must have come into an epiphany, whole life changed in 24 hours, and he's completely rethought his entire life, and now he's a brand new person, which is highly unlikely. Most people, especially by that age, are not going to just switch their entire lives around overnight without some thought. All right, so number 7 is tu quoque. And it essentially means, well, yeah, but you do it too. Anybody ever heard that one?
Never.
Used on you? Yeah, but you do it. Kids are really good at this one. And I think spouses are really good at this one toward each other. So when an inconsistency is pointed out in an argument, or, we see this even in actions a lot of times. And yes?
It's like hypocrite?
Yeah, kind of just yelling, you're a hypocrite. So I'm not wrong for doing what I'm doing because you're a hypocrite. We might say there's similar things to just relational dynamics between spouses where, maybe somebody did something that made somebody else upset and then that person lashed out at them and they go back and forth and the one says, sorry, but, you're really the reason why this happened. So it's a sorry, but not really a sorry. You ever have a sorry that's really not a sorry? Sorry, but you're the problem. Yeah. Yeah, it happens a lot. All the married couples are just looking at each other. Never. All right, so when an inconsistency is pointed out in an argument, the person simply points out that the other person also has inconsistencies and does not deal with the fault in their argument, but proceeds on. So don't tell me not to be harsh with the kids. You just yelled at them yesterday. You ever have that with parenting where you lose your temper and then the other spouse comes around? It's like, oh, you should be gentler on them. And it's like, yeah, but yeah, yesterday you just yelled at them. Now, am I distracting from the point that, yes, I lost my temper and I shouldn't have done that? But pointing out the inconsistency in the partner, is that just distracting rather than owning my mistake?
Yeah.
So the same is true in an argument. If I'm arguing and they point out, hey, you have a flaw in your logic or your argumentation, and you just go, well, you have a flaw in yours in this point. Did I address the supposed flaw in my argument?
No.
No. So what happens if I actually had a flaw in my argument that needed changing and I just moved on and pretended like it didn't exist? So, not a tu quoque. Why are you telling me it's wrong to read fiction? You do it too. So why is this one not twofold quay? So this second example, why are you telling me it's wrong to read fiction? You do it too. Why is that not too colloquy? Why is that more legit?
Inviting a conversation.
I'm inviting a conversation. I'm asking a question, but I'm also asking a question based on, like, why are you doing this? Like, if it is truly wrong, am I invalidating and saying it can't possibly be wrong for me to read, or am I having that conversation like, okay, now it's weird that you're saying it because you do this. Mm-hmm. So is it actually wrong, or are you also participating in something that's wrong? You know, what's, this doesn't make sense to me, right? So if somebody comes up and says, you know, oh, let's get an example. Let's say at work you use something that you think is okay to use for a personal use, like office supplies. You use a pen for some personal use, or you take a personal call at work, right? Some policies, no personal calls at work. Sometimes it is okay, sometimes not. So you take a personal call, and your coworker, who takes personal calls all day long, walks up to you and says, you know it's wrong for you to do that. Okay, is it, though? Because, like, I thought it was okay, and I see you do it all the time, so why are you telling me it's wrong? Is it actually wrong, or you just don't want me to do it? Okay, any questions on any of those so far? All right, number 8, ad ignoratum. So essentially is an argument from silence. You might also be called an argument from silence. You probably hear that more often. This fallacy is an appeal to a lack of information. So, it can be a lack of the arguer's knowledge, so that we would say charitably that they are ignorant of what they're actually talking about, so that's why their argument's wrong. Or, on the lack of the listener, so that's more malicious. So, nobody has proven it to be false, so it must be true. Not necessarily, right? Just because nobody's proven whatever wrong yet, especially if I just came up with it. So if this is an argument I just came up with and nobody's heard it yet, does that make me right because nobody's proved it wrong yet? No. So UFOs must be alien spaceships because the government has never offered any other satisfactory explanation. They have to be aliens. Okay? Are there some loaded terms in there, possibly? Mm-hmm. Like what?
Must be, never. Satisfactory.
Why is satisfactory kind of loaded? What if I said it like this? There is no good evidence to believe in God's existence.
Isn't that kind of subjective?
It is completely subjective, right? Because what do you mean by satisfactory explanation? Or what do you mean by good evidence for God? There's no evidence for God. Well, what do you mean by evidence? Like, what constitutes evidence for you? Right? So, a non-ignoratum. I remind the jury that my client is innocent until proven guilty. Why is that not? Although we are appealing to a lack of information, right? Because we need information to convict. And we don't have any, so we're going to assume them innocent until we get some, right? So yes, are we appealing to ignorance? Lack of information, in other words. We're appealing to a lack of information, but it's not illegitimate at this point. All right, number 9, chronological snobbery, or a fallacy related to time. So you commit this fallacy when you reject or affirm a position solely based on how old or new it is.
Yes.
Traditionalists commit this fallacy one way and modernists in another. Traditionalists will say that it is old and therefore it is good. The modernist says that it is old and therefore bad. Right? So you have two different camps. Old is good or old is bad. Or new is good, new is bad. So a couple examples. Categorical logic may have worked for Aristotle, but it's outdated now. So Aristotle lived a long time ago. So Aristotelian logic is very old. Does that make it bad?
No.
Or invalid?
Or no longer used? Maybe this person is making a categorical statement.
Yeah, they might be making a categorical statement themselves. So could we test that statement by categorical syllogism, make a syllogism out of it, put it in a form and see if it's any good?
Yeah.
We could, but we don't have to. It's chronological snobbery. Right? It doesn't make it wrong just because it's old. Now, what would we have to see to say that categorical logic or Aristotelian logic is now no longer good? What would we need to see?
You have to see it falsified.
Yeah.
And something positive to replace it.
Right. It would need to be falsified and replaced by something that worked better. Do we have anything to replace it?
No, because you would probably use it in your attempt to deny it.
Exactly. You can't escape it. You're going to use Aristotelian logic in order to try to falsify Aristotelian logic, which is self-defeating. So going back to our verse we started with, those that oppose themselves. If I have to use it in order to support the premise that it doesn't exist or shouldn't be used anymore, I've just completely negated my point altogether. So another one. The oldest manuscripts read such and such, therefore they must be right. I knew that one would get you. The oldest manuscripts say such and such, therefore they must be right. So what's wrong with it? They could have been wrong in the first place, yeah. Does age automatically mean it's good?
No.
Age automatically mean it's bad?
No.
So what do we judge things on? Their age or what?
The merit.
The merit. How close to truth does it actually fall? Another one, dispensationalism is new, beginning with Darby, some say, and therefore novel and probably wrong. So this would be a common refrain we get from our Reformed brothers and sisters, because they believe theirs is much older, and therefore it must be better, because it's stood the test of time for a very long time. So Reformed theology must be true because it's old, and goes all the way back to Augustine in some cases. So therefore, it has to be right.
Therefore, Catholicism is correct too.
No, they're the worst. The Reformed do not like the Catholics, even though they share quite a bit of their doctrine. They really don't like them. I don't get it. It's a weird. I guess if you got to make a draw sharp lines in the sand, you have to hate your opponent. So, all
right. Hey, you got a question right here?
Where?
Dave.
Oh, Dave. Sorry.
I was thinking of this for like. Things that are old
mm-hmm.
are false. If you put that into reasoning,
mm-hmm.
some older books are false. The
mm-hmm.
Bible's old, therefore the Bible is false.
Right, so we could put it into categorical statements. We could put it into a form, get that all the way boiled down, see is this form even valid? And then if it is valid, then we would start looking at each premise and saying, is this premise true and can we support it with evidence, facts, and everything else? So yeah, exactly. That's exactly what we're looking for. If somebody says that, can we turn that into a categorical statement? Can we turn that statement into a syllogism? Can we assess that syllogism for its validity? Obviously, that's not as easy to do on your feet in a conversation, but it's definitely something you think about. Go back home, jot it down, start working through the process, and then come up with a This worked, I think this worked a lot better in the olden days. This is why people don't do it as much anymore, because back then, somebody had a problem with you, they might publicly debate you, but then you might have correspondence letters back and forth. And when they write you a letter, you get to sit down and look at it, read it, dissect it, write a letter back, send it back. Or if you're doing it in the newspaper, they put out a column, a couple days later you might put out a column in response, and it's going over time. You have time. So in today's society, do we often have time to sit and think and come up with a response? Or are they, I want a response right now. Right now. Say it. Go. Go. If you can't say something right now, you're wrong. Right? All right. So what is not chronological snobbery? An example of non-chronological snobbery says, I think we should be more careful before we dismiss something our ancestors have done for centuries. So why is that not chronological snobbery? Even though I'm appealing to something that's old.
You're leaving yourself open to the fact that they might have had wisdom in what they were doing.
Right.
I'm
not definitively saying what they did was automatically right in every point, but am I saying, hey, they've done this for centuries, it's worked pretty good, like, let's not just dump it because I'm actually just I'm almost anti chronological stop reading. I'm not saying the new stuff's wrong. What I am saying, hey, some of this old stuff might still have value. Let's tread lightly before we just chuck it out. All right, so we got a couple minutes left. Do we have any questions on any of that?
I think what historians would call presentism fits under chronological snobbery as well.
Yeah, so presentism, for those who are less aware, is the idea, and correct me if I'm wrong on any point, Brian, but where you read into history thoughts of today, cultural things of today, maybe definitions of words today, you read that into the past and try to assign it to them.
Yeah.
Like things that are going on culturally today, you might try to say that's the motive for why this guy did that 18 centuries ago.
Yeah, or like, would the King James translators be King James only?
Right.
Like that's even a thing that they were thinking about then. Like,
right.
It's just a ridiculous
right.
trap.
So, right, modern thoughts, modern theology in a lot of ways is something wholly unknown to centuries ago. So, like any systematic theology, regardless where it's coming from, Reformed, dispensational, or something else, that whole systematized theology that we have today, that was wholly unheard of 300 years ago. Like, they didn't have systematic theology books back then. They had some doctrine and stuff like that, but to systematize it all into one volume, that's unheard of. So to say that they all thought that way, because they didn't have to. A lot of the theology back then was reactive to heresies. So they didn't have this nice, neat system. It would be we all have common beliefs, and until those are challenged by something, we don't really need to have a statement against it, because it's kind of like thinking about a statement against something that doesn't exist. Why would you develop a system and a theology or a doctrine against something that doesn't exist yet? Would I need a theology to counter Reformed theology before Reformed theology existed? No. So, yes, a lot of the early fathers don't talk about some of like the dispensational points that we have today. They didn't need it. They didn't need to go against it until it became a problem. So, I'll give a couple examples. Can we identify the fallacy of distraction that's being made in these following examples? So, first one. Oswald must have been the lone assassin of Kennedy. No one has ever been able to prove any of the conspiracy theories. So Oswald must have been the lone assassin of Kennedy. No one has ever been able to prove any of the conspiracy theories. What fallacy am I using of distraction?
Ad ignorantium.
Yep, ad ignorantium. I'm appealing to a lack of information. Because none of the conspiracy theories have been proven, then it must have been Oswald and he must have acted alone. Sure, we got some good conspiracies about that one too. Alright, number two. Santa Claus must be real. The editor of the newspaper said so. Ipsy Dixit. Alright. If you believe in Jesus because, or sorry, you believe in Jesus because you were brought up in a Christian home.
Genetic
fallacy. Genetic, or the other name for genetic fallacy starts with a B. Bulverism. Four, we need to appropriate billions of dollars for AIDS research. Otherwise, you or someone in your family will probably get AIDS within the next 10 years.
Appeal to fear.
Appeal to fear. It also technically would be an ad baculum because it's an appeal to fear, but I separate those two. All right. You don't believe that Genesis is to be understood literally, do you? That's a rather old-fashioned doctrine.
Chronological snobbery.
Alright, we should say the Pledge of Allegiance at our assemblies just like other schools do.
Ad populum.
A heretic named Cervantes was burned at the stake in Geneva, and John Calvin approved of it. Calvinism has to be wrong.
Ad hominem.
You can't tell me it's wrong to cheat. You cheated before, too. Tu quoque, do you agree with me when I say that mankind is corrupt? That proves that you have been corrupted already. Therefore, we don't have to listen to your opinion.
We don't have to listen to your opinion.
Right. But what is that? What distraction?
Did you do it too?
No, but that's a good close. I mean, it almost could go that way depending on how they followed it up. So do you disagree with me when I say that mankind is corrupt? So think about a debate. I say, hey, do you agree that mankind is corrupt? Yeah, I believe mankind is corrupt. Well, then you're corrupt and we don't have to listen to you.
That's a polarism.
Ad hominem, right? You're corrupt, therefore.
Oh, you're corrupt.
All right. The senator is accused of communist activities, and there is nothing to disprove these suspicions.
Ad ignoranum.
Ad ignoranum. You should read this book that your boss wrote. You would not want to jeopardize your position in this company, would you? Ad baculum. I'm appealing to fear. The vice president said that the potato is spelled with an E at the end, so it must be true.
Ipsy
dixit. Professor Pepper thinks teachers should get paid more so they won't leave teaching for other jobs, but he's a teacher himself, so that figures. Professor Pepper thinks teachers should get paid more so they don't leave teaching for other jobs. But he's a teacher himself, so that figures. So we don't really got to pay any attention to it. Not ad hominem, but close.
Bulverism.
Alright. My dad tells me that I shouldn't shoplift, but I don't listen to him because I happen to know that he stole candy from stores when he was a kid. Tu quoque. And of course God exists. Alright, of course God exists. Belief in a deity is one of the most ancient concepts of man.
Crap, snobbery.
Chronological snobbery. Alright, so, you see, like, a lot of these are often used, especially if you watch politics, or religious debates, quite often politics and religion. You're going to get a lot of these informal fallacies. So next week we'll continue with another type of informal fallacies. I forget, that is the fallacies of ambiguity. So I am purposely kind of masking what the problem is through language or something like that.